Yeah. And I love it when I throw it into GitHub and like, I just see, cause you know, it does takes a little while to do the code search. Right. And yeah. then, so like my eyes just sort of laser in on like the code search and it's going dot, 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 dot. And then when it comes up with something that's not a zero,
yes.
I'm like, yes. And then I go to it and it's like somebody putting their freaking
recon data online.
Recon data on GitHub. Alrighty, y'all. I've been telling you for the past couple of weeks about ThreatLocker Detect, right? Bunch of cool logging, a bunch of cool remediation methods that have built in right into that automation in the ThreatLocker Detect system. But at the end of the day, there's nothing quite like having a human in the loop for these sort of incidents. And back when I was a consultant, you know, one of the techniques that we would use pretty often was if we had a team that was pretty active in incident response, like they were fighting us as we were trying to get into the systems, we would just switch to nights because nobody feels like getting their butt out of bed and going to the computer and fighting off the red teamer, right, in the middle of the night. And so that worked a lot of the time, but ThreatLocker's got your back in a situation just like this as well, because they've got a product, an add-on for their ThreatLocker Detect system called Cyber Hero Managed Detect and Response. And this employs a 24/7 monitoring service of cyber heroes that are there to fight off attackers in your network, which one, sounds hella intimidating, and two, makes sense that you would want a human in the loop there. Yeah, what a lot of people don't realize too is there's time zones, right? So it could be the middle of the day for someone in Asia, it could be middle of the night here, you know, in the US. So it's really important to have someone 24/7 kind of working on those systems to defend it. And ThreatLocker has got your back with that, with their MDR product. All right, cool. Let's go back to the show. All right, let's just go ahead and start the recording and you can just tell me what you were just saying. So I was asking you, like, because this research came out by Noggly, right? Like, what the heck is this DeepSeek thing? And dude, there's so much drama around this. So it's like a state-of-the-art model
yes.
for local stuff. Yes. And it's from China and it's getting pwned and it's potentially stolen from OpenAI. What's the situation here?
Yeah. So, well, I'll try to give a quick overview. Basically, there's a bunch of buzz around it because if it's actually easy to create state-of-the-art models, then all these companies that have raised like tens of billions of dollars didn't actually need that. And supposedly DeepSeek only spent $5 million on training. If that's actually true, then all of the huge funding that's going on by companies like OpenAI and Anthropic is kind of like, quote unquote, unnecessary.
It's just like a cash grab then at that point. Yeah,
that's right. But most people think that they're lying about how much it costs them to train it, because if they told the real number, it would mean that they have access to too many chips. And there's like an embargo saying they're only allowed to have so many chips sold to them. So if they admitted to higher training costs, they would have to admit to owning more chips. And then at that point, they would be in trouble. And so they have to kind of say this lower number. It also makes them look way more impressive. And if they want to seem more impressive, then they want to throw out a lower number. One way they could have done it with a lot less training data is with a lot higher quality data. And that's why everyone's blaming them for stealing OpenAI's like O1's thought process. So one thing you can do to train a model almost to a comparable level is take the output from a smarter model and then use that as your input data, right? People are claiming that they were using like
but
a
that
VPN.
Must have cost like an insane amount of money, right? If they're just hitting OpenAI constantly.
Well, if you paid for the $200 a month subscription, you get unlimited access to O1 and O1 Pro. And if you've noticed, OpenAI has been under a ton of load and even went down a few times. So it's like maybe they were contributing to that. It's so hard to know. So yes, the Wiz team and then also like two or three other hackers all found this kind of at the same time. I got messaged about it from Haxler and then I shared it with the Palisade guys, you know, Sam Curry and Zaya and those guys and Chill. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of poking on it, looking at it because it was pretty interesting. X posted something, exactly, Mike posted about it today on Twitter, that what he thought was interesting was that they're like this system prompt sort of thing that's like basically, you know, to promote and support and follow all the rules in China. And so there's so much interestingness about this. There was like 300 million records million records or something in the database that leaked, but it was a you know, dev database, but you know, maybe that was that training data from OpenAI, maybe it was real user data. It's really hard to know.
It
was mostly telemetry. So
what actually happened was, like, I'm just reading the article here, was Noggly found this exposed database, right? And
it's like
ClickHouse and was able to query some data out of there that was related to the functionality of DeepSeek.
Yeah.
And it looked like, I mean, according to his X thread, it was just like just a straight recon win. Like you just find this port on this host and then the database is just wide open.
Yeah. Did you see the, let me see if I can share this very small window. Oh, actually, I'll just read it to you. So an nmap scan of that host, here was the port that were open, 443, 1090, 1091, 2053, 2087, 2096, 5140, 8002, 8040, 8041. All these are real services. And it just keeps going. There was like 50. It lit up like a Christmas tree if you scanned it with nmap. Absolutely zero NetSec or InfoSec knowledge in regards to opening up those ports on dev.deepsea.
It must have been like presumed to be an internal server or something like that, and then they just like stuck it on the internet.
Maybe. So there's the theory or the description about this company is that they're a bunch of like they're like a quant trading firm, and this is like their side gig, and they like actually don't care about it that much. If that's true, and they actually are already rich from some other, you know, financial sector thing, and they're just a bunch of smart people who are good at ML and AI stuff, maybe they actually don't have security expertise. It's hard to know.
Wow. Pretty crazy, dude. Well, either way, nice find by Nogli and apparently like six other hackers on Twitter. So
yeah,
that's a pretty cool find for sure. All right. Well, we jumped right into the news, but that was one of the news items. And another one that I had sort of on my list here was PortSwigger Research has put out two really quality pieces of content. One is the bypass bot detection BAP in the BAP store, which is something that I think is becoming a little bit more of an issue recently. Is like
it really is
these like WAFs are doing TLS fingerprints on the proxy softwares and blocking it. So this BAP allows you to emulate the browser fingerprints of you know, various browsers and stuff like that inside of Burp and sort of bypass those problems, which is, I think, really cool. And something I think I mentioned on the pod a while back was like, I think it's called CFFI or something like that, CFFI curl Python library that allows you to do this for Python. And it's nice to see it integrated, you know, into a HTTP proxy directly.
Yeah, this is, I feel like, going to keep being an issue now that there are things like Operator, which we're going to talk a lot about. As you're trying to prevent AI agents from browsing like humans, captures get worse and worse. There was a HackerOne challenge that me and a few others were hacking on like yesterday or the day before, and it was like 10 steps. And each captcha was like 5 to 6 clicks. You had to like rotate something around to make it point the same direction as other stuff. And I don't know why there was 10 steps, like surely 5's enough. And it's super frustrating. It's like when your time is valuable, which, you know, ours definitely is, you don't want to spend like 3 minutes filling out a captcha. And then when it fails, you just want to rage quit and throw your computer across the room.
Exactly, dude. It's like, all right, turn on your webcam, hold up 7 fingers, now 3 fingers, now just 1 finger.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's pretty crazy, man. I think they will continue to get worse and worse and worse. And we'll swing back around to the other PortSwigger piece of research that I was going to mention.
Okay, but I definitely want to talk about it too. So
But the it makes me think, because like you were saying, as we're testing all these applications, we often have to do these captchas and re-auth and that sort of thing. And that makes me think of a tweet by Sweetly that he put out not too long ago, that was essentially giving you a way to do like a 2FA sort of thing from the command line. And I was like, oh my gosh, why haven't I thought about this, right? So apparently there's this app, github.com/rsc/2FA. We'll put it in the description. But it allows you to just have a command line utility be your 2FA like authenticator app provider.
And it works with like a match replace too, where you can actually put it in the thing and it happens automatically, right?
Yeah, well, he integrated it with, so it's just a command line tool, but he integrated it with one of my favorite like efficiency tools called Espanso. And now you can just type colon OTP and it just like drops your OTP code right into the text box. So pretty awesome. I love that he shared this.
Yeah, I'm hoping Mac will build that in eventually. I'm sure you get this a little bit with at least having an iPhone, but you know how it'll automatically fill the text from SMS for like for 2FA?
Yeah, they had that on Android too, and I don't have an iPhone. I'm Android.
Sorry.
I'm a full Android shop. Excuse me.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that obviously is nice. And I've been wanting that for web too. Like, I'm sure, I guess Android probably has shared clipboard. Are you able to share your phone to your Windows machine clipboard?
We could probably,
okay.
You know, it's not native.
Yeah. So that's one thing I use a lot too, is like when I'm copying and pasting 2FA codes out of the Authenticator app, I copy it on my phone and then I just hit Command V on my computer and it's really fast. But, this thing from Sweetly is going to be nice. Dude, as well.
That makes me a little jealous. I'm not going to lie, man. If you have shared, like seamless shared clipboard, there is a thing on Google that on the Pixel devices where you can go and like share a specific tab to a different device and it'll like pop up on the other device and stuff like that. And it's pretty easy to use and seamless. But man, I've just been realizing over time, like the iOS ecosystem is so nice. They put so much effort into making it nice. And I've just been, a Linux, Android, Windows subsystem for Linux boy for such a long time. But I don't know, man. It might be time to make the jump. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough decision. That's for sure. I like the flexibility that it has. Honestly, this is off our notes, but, you know, sometimes it's more fun when it goes off the rails. The latest MBKHD video has him like testing out Android XR. And so it's basically the Android operating system for augmented reality. And the first headset, it looks just like the Vision Pro, but it's made by Samsung. But the killer feature is I'm getting really bullish on Google AI. Because Flash 2 is amazing. And like both Gemini and Flash are the best at multimodal processing.
So good.
So in this video, in Android XR, Marquez says, oh, actually, by the way, right there on Google Maps, can you zoom me in to the Bronx? And it just does it for him because it has natural language-based navigation of the operating system in Android XR through Gemini.
No way.
Yeah, it feels like he's in Ready Player One or something. I was like, what? This is coming? And so,
is it fast? Yeah. I could see that happening right now, I've seen, multimodal AI and I could see that working, but like, I feel like it would be like, hey, zoom in to the Bronx. And then it's like 3, 2, 1. All right, we're in the Bronx, then we start zooming to the Bronx and then it takes like 5 seconds to zoom to the Bronx and then, we're there. So how fast was it?
It seemed relatively quick, but of course, it could be magic editing or whatever else, but he seemed impressed with it and it seemed really impressive to me. So,
to be honest, I trust him, man. If he's impressed with it, I mean, if he wasn't impressed with it, he would say, I'm not impressed with this.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I just think it's really cool because everyone's been waiting for what the open source operating system was going to be for that, for AR and VR. So,
dude, you mentioned Flash 2, man. That update you did to Shift was like legendary, man. Oh, seriously, I hit Joseph up one night and I was like, hey, man, I've been using Shift, which is our tool that we built together, AI integrated into Kaito. And you can find that at shiftplugin.com. I was using it to do some hacking on Google. And I was like, man, lately it's been a little slow. It's been a little dumb. Like, I really think we need to step this up a little bit. And so I integrated some things on the client side. And I was like, Joseph, can you hook it up to the smarter model to Flash 2? And then he just pounded it out one night with a bunch of other really nice features. And I tried it again the next morning and it was working so well on big requests. Cause that was the problem we were running into before. It was the requests that we were modifying were massive and you have to shove all of those tokens into the LLM. And then if you're generating the whole request, it has to then just spit out all those tokens. So the re-architecture that you did plus adding it to the smarter model, which is still lightning fast, is unbelievable.
Yeah. There's definitely some trade secrets there on the how to make the replace work in the editing that I think is then you had added all of that already. So it's perfect.
Yeah. Sorry. I'll try not to spill all of our trade secrets. I don't know what my deal is, man. But I realized recently that I just have no filter on CTVB. I've just become so comfortable on this podcast. It's like talking to my wife, I'm just just say it exactly how it is. And then I'm just realizing it just gets put out there to thousands of people. Yeah.
Well, not just that, but then it's searchable for all of eternity. That's really the bigger issue, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm high on openness too. But one thing I was going to circle back to, we almost got got to when we were talking about CAPTCHAs, and it's in my list of things to talk about. I posted about Operator. So ChatGPT's Operator is basically a computer use agent that they rolled out. And there's a lot of interesting things here. One, I found a cool bug. It was basically an ad order to read other people's prompts and stuff, which is neat. It's already paid out, but
nice.
But
the, they fixed it already. Already paid. Like, have you had a good experience with the OpenAI team?
Yeah, they are. I will say that, like, you know, they're pretty secure, which is kind of annoying because so it's hard to find stuff. And when you do, it's usually like a medium or a low because it requires a unique ID because they're doing things properly. So that's kind of frustrating. But in general, they're great to work with. So, well, I mean, they've kind of also been slammed by fake reports for the last 2 years because LLMs hallucinate bugs so quickly, so much, like so well. Anyways, so on the Operator, one thing that I tweeted that went kind of viral, and I think it's worth talking about for this community because the InfoSec is so passionate about like just having like good secure design. And there's almost no good secure design at this point in time for AI agents, so it's really tough. But this thing is very similar to Rabbit in the way that it's kind of like a VNC portal that's just like working. And so it has to have your credentials to do things. And I just wanted to make like a PSA here that if you use an Operator, you know, I've worked at an enterprise company at AppOmni and other people have too. Like those backend engineers definitely have access to the database. They have access to your account. They can log in as you. They can see the data you put in there. Like maybe they don't very often. Maybe there are good controls around that. But in general, you should assume that those credentials are accessible by them. And so for these AI agents to work, you have to give them creds, right? And so if you give them credentials to your email, you are basically also giving up that those credentials to anyone who works at OpenAI. I'm not saying they'll use them. I'm not saying they'll abuse them. But it's just like there's a trust barrier there that you're giving up that I think people should be aware of.
Yeah. And I think that's got to be true in any scenario. And companies can try to put, you know, guardrails up, but especially in these sort of like, oh, it's a browser, you know, sort of scenarios, like where you've got like this VNC portal, it just kind of feels like your native environment where you're like comfortable and you're like, oh, let me just go through this like 2FA flow and just log into my account really quick. That being said, I also have built some automation recently that utilizes just my normal browser. Via it wasn't Puppeteer. I'm trying to. It uses DevTools protocol in Chrome. Cool. I can't remember the name of the library right now for some reason. But I just for some reason when I was thinking about using headless Chrome or whatever, I was always thinking like, oh, it's got to be headless. But it doesn't have to be headless. You can just like use your browser that you're actually using, you know, on a day to day basis to automate tasks. So I had like this particular flow that I needed to go through like a million times and I needed to use my cookies and stuff like that. And I was like, how do I like go through the auth on this headless browser and I give it the cookies? And it just was becoming a mess. And then I realized, wow, I can just like turn on DevTools protocol on my normal browser and just hook it up to this. And then it just goes through the process in my browser, like while I'm watching.
Yeah.
Which makes it really easy to debug too. So I think getting comfortable with those tools can really help make some of those like semi-manual processes that you have to do a lot more automated, a lot more clean.
Yeah. And I think that is the paradigm going forward that's going to be best for most people is that they're going to host their own second laptop server, whatever, VM, and it's going to just use computer use in there on their own hardware so that they don't have to like give up those cookies. And Rabbit tried to claim that a long time ago. It's like, oh, we don't store your credentials. We only store your cookies. It's like, yeah, but cookies is access, right? And so,
yeah, like your credentials are on the page for like 1 second, you know, on any application. And then it's a cookie from there on out. I know that Network Chuck is really big on the whole, like have your own, what did he name the server? It's like Tracy or something that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, have your own private AI server and then kind of try to build your workflows around private AI first. And I just, you know, I was really kind of, I don't know, I am still a little bit bearish on that. You know, I just like, the models are just so much better when they run on the provider's, you know, hardware or whatever. But
yeah, but as things get
better.
Think about it from a company though. So I was too, and I still kind of am, but I've recently had a conversation with Marcus from like head of AI security at KPMG. And he kind of convinced me otherwise. I think he's going to be doing a talk at DEF CON actually about this. I might reach out to him and see if we need to bleep this. But basically, these model providers are quantizing their models when they're under heavy load. So they actually do get dumber, which is a theory that's been going around. That like when there's more load that the models get dumber, that's actually true. Because they have like an on-the-fly quantization that like uses a slightly smaller model. So when you're using the model when no one else is using it, it's at full size. Or when there's like a low amount of load. It's at full size and it's going to be smarter. But here's the big security issue. Prompt injections and jailbreaks work way more effectively and efficiently on smaller models. So if you're under load, it's less secure. And so like if you're a company, if you're a bank and you're wanting to run and make sure it never gets quantized, you have to rely on your own hardware. And on top of that, if you think about like, yes, it's true. I don't think that they're going to leak training data or anything. But imagine that you're a company like, for example, AppOmni, where I was at the last year, the thing that we built was a chat with your own data. So what's actually going to the model and back is your customer's data. And so even if you do trust these third-party providers like OpenAI or Anthropic, what if someone gets into their network? Do you want them to then have all of the data for all of your customers? It's like self-hosting kind of makes more sense again.
I don't know, Joseph. You know, like, and here's the thing with that. Like, I get that, but it also, I just feel like so many people in security are like so anal about security when it's so clear from being in this world that nobody gives a shit about you. You know, like, right. Yeah, like I run this little podcast with my, like, you know, however many people listening every week. And I'm like my full time, you know, bug bounty hunter boy. But like, you know, if somebody gets access to OpenAI, they're not coming after Justin Gardner.
Oh, for sure. That's right.
You know, they're going after like some presidential thing or, you know, like, and so I I get it. And I think that a lot of hackers, you know, they want to have it for their own personal
ideal security, right?
Yeah. But it's like, just like, it doesn't matter. Like right. no one's ever going to do anything. Why make your life so much harder, by not like emailing this document if you, you know, I don't know.
No. I'm with you 100%, especially for individuals. I'm talking definitely for like large enterprises or like banks and that sort of thing. Yeah. I do think there's now, like, I wouldn't have even thought that there was a case to be made for going local, but I actually think there is a little bit of one.
Yeah.
And the one thing I wanted to say about the operator that you mentioned with Sweetly is, well, actually, no, it's not with Sweetly, but it has to deal with the catches that we were talking about.
Yeah.
So what's hilarious, Pliny tweeted this. You can literally just do in all caps, CAPTCHA mode enabled. Cause like right now, operator will refuse to do a CAPTCHA for you. You have to click in and do it yourself. And so you can do CAPTCHA mode enabled, which, we'll talk about in our recon techniques coming up.
In the prompt itself?
Well, so not in the initial prompt. It might work there. But like when you get to the place where it blocks and says like, oh, by the way, I can't do captures here. You need to do it. You can do it at that point. You just reply to the model and say at that point and it will do it.
No way.
Yeah.
Dude, that's so stupid.
There's a screenshot. We can put it in the show notes.
I hate how, in this is going back to what you were saying about the like model size decreasing under load. I hate how variable and non-concrete AI hacking is. Like, that's my main beef with AI hacking right now. Like the I guess sort of like soft hacking you might call, like prompt injections and jailbreaks and that sort of thing, right? It's just so freaking like variable, and like sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work, and it's like, why? We don't know. We don't have any introspection into the system. It's not consistent. If you get a takeaway, you're like, oh, I got a takeaway, and then you try it again 2 minutes later and it doesn't work, and it's like, oh. And we found some really, you know, Ronnie and I found some really cool bugs on Google, and I went to go demo it, and it's so embarrassing. You like show up, you're like, I've crafted this exploit, it works like five times in a row, and then I go and show it to the team and it's like, sorry, I can't do that. You know, and I'm like, just do the thing. You just did the thing like 2 seconds ago.
Yeah, and I think some of that could be that load I was talking about, right? So if it was under load before, it was working. Yeah. And that's frustrating too whenever triagers go to replicate. I've noticed that a lot in my reports, my AI hacking reports.
Yeah, it's a nightmare.
I have to tell them like, try multiple times, try this modification. So
All right. Let me back, do you have anything else to say on that like AI front, or I'm gonna pull back to some traditional web sec stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see. So yeah, the other thing that I was going to mention that I mentioned like 10 minutes ago was another piece of research. And I'm totally going to butcher this guy's name, but it's like Zakhar Fedukin, it's D4D. He's a Portswigger researcher. This is something that was really interesting. And actually Matan and I actually had done some research on this that is that's a Critical Thinkers exclusive. So we sort of have part of this technique already documented in the exclusive content on the Discord. But the concept here was a cookie sandwich and tricking the server into thinking that a specific cookie should be parsed with sort of legacy RFC compatibility mode, which includes the ability to quote cookies.
Yeah.
So like the way that we were dealing with it, it's like, oh, if you you know, use a server that deals with this like legacy compatibility mode where you have a cookie, you know, X equals double quote, and then like a cookie, it will go to the next double quote, even if there's like a semicolon, right? Which is where the cookie should break typically. Yeah. But what the researcher here, D4D, sort of came up with was a way, you know, a more technical way of actually addressing this, which is he analyzed how Apache Tomcat and some of the other common web servers are you know, going into this cookie compatibility mode. Mm-hmm. And he found a way to trigger it, which is by providing a cookie that is starts with $version with a capital V. Mm. And when Apache Tomcat sees that, it will switch to legacy parsing logic and allow you to sort of quote various cookies, which can allow you to encapsulate other cookies, like HTTP-only cookies, for example, in a cookie that's reflected on the page. So you can get access to a session cookie via JavaScript, which typically is impossible if you're able to get the session cookie encapsulated in a cookie that's reflected. You can do all sorts of other fun stuff like this with a session manipulation on certain endpoints by setting the version cookie to only be on a specific path.
Yeah.
So, and that sort of does the thing that we were talking about before, where you're like partially logged in, partially not logged in on some endpoints with like that Matan was talking about. So there's lots of really good applications here. There's some stuff for PHP. There's some stuff for Python. We'll link this write up in the description as well. I should be sharing my screen. I'm not sharing my screen right now. Sorry.
So where's the cookie sandwich part of this?
Yeah. So that's the piece that with the double quotes thing, right? So you have one parameter in the front that's like, here, hold on, let me just.
No. I understand now. Sorry. Anytime I hear sandwich attack, I think of like Lupin's research and that sort of thing, where you basically, like, you know, Lupin with V1 of UUIDs has talked about sandwich attacks before,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
you generate a bunch or you generate two at like a very short time frame, and you're able to sandwich in and then basically, you know, predict or guess the other value for that. That's what I was looking for in this. This is like a completely different type of sandwich.
Totally different type of sandwich. So many sandwiches in hacking, man. But yeah. This one is an interesting one because, you know, in JavaScript, you can set the version cookie and then you can set, you know, param one and then have the session sort of secret get manipulated, put it in the middle, and then param two. And what will happen with this is if it starts with the version cookie, then it'll be legacy parsing logic, then param one equals double quote, and then it can the value of param one semicolon, then it starts the browser thinks that the next cookie is starting, right?
That's right.
So session ID equals secret, that's HTTP only cookie, semicolon, thinks the end of the session cookie is happening. And then you've got param two equals, you know, whatever, and then double quote, right? And the browser perceives that param two as its separate cookie, session ID is its own cookie, param one is its own cookie. Mm-hmm. But really that param two, when it ends that double quote, the server is sort of perceiving that as one cookie, param one equals double quote, session ID equals secret, param two equals whatever, double quote. And that last double quote ends the param one cookie.
Yep.
So it's sort of like using this double quote manipulation to encapsulate cookies inside of other cookies, which could be reflected into the page or cause unintended effects on the server with authentication. Does that sort of make sense?
Yep. No, it makes perfect sense. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really thought that was cool research. There's stuff for PHP. There's stuff for Python, which I think some Python servers are vulnerable to this just by default.
Practically speaking, you're going to have control of a cookie though, to even get this started and to use the version thing, you'd have to have access to the first cookie.
Well, you can, if you have XSS, you can use like, cookie jar overflows or just unsetting cookies and that sort of thing to get your cookie to the front.
Got it.
And the ordering of the cookies is actually determined by the path that it's set at. And then I believe after that, when the cookie was set. So by utilizing a more specific path on the cookie, you can bump your cookie to the front.
Got it.
And then trigger this whole thing.
Cool.
So, definitely some cool stuff there. It will definitely take some manipulation, but especially when you have like an XSS on a subdomain or something like that, where you can set cookies and then like a login, log out, CSERF.
Yep.
You can sort of churn through the cookies, set one, you know, and then log the user back in, get the cookie set, and then set another cookie to create the sandwich.
Yep.
And then you may be able to extract the session token. It's a pretty cool technique.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah. So a little bit heavy on the technical explanation there, but hopefully that was clear for everybody who's listening on audio.
Yeah, let's jump to something less technical, because I've got two left, and one is very technical on the cache geolocation attack, but I'm going to jump to Douglas Day. So the Archangel, we all know him well. And also, man, I don't know if we mentioned this before. If we didn't, we should have, but his domain is so cool. Douglas.day. His last name is a TLD, so you get the dot last name.
So badass.
Yeah, pretty cool. But anyway, so he tweeted about, we'll put this in the show notes, of course. He tweeted about this and then also posted on his blog, basically just this idea of report pointers. And so you often want to, especially when it comes to, like, you require a specific ID in the application. And one person, you know, used that in their report, for example, because they were able to leak the ID of other organizations, and they were able to, you know, do some sort of IDOR to change or update or read that information about another organization. And so then maybe they don't want to share that later, or maybe there's not an Oracle or a way to leak IDs now in the future, but you want the company to take your report seriously because there has been in the past. Mm-hmm. So he comes up with this idea of what he called it collaborative chains or something else initially.
Report pointers for collaborative chains.
Yeah, but the report pointers, I messaged him because someone else commented on his or told me about it. And I was like, dude, this is called a report pointer and it's so much better naming. And so then he like went back and edited it to like make that the name.
Yeah, NBK, I think, was the guy that did it. That's awesome.
Yeah, so report pointers is what it's called. It basically is just a way for, if you need to share or point back to prior research in a previous report, you can just say in your report on HackerOne or BugCrowd or Integrity, just put right there like, and for how to get IDs, reference this report for how to do it or how it was done in the past as a way to show the value. And there are probably lots of other examples. I like the ID leaking examples. I think he mentioned something different.
We've actually done this in the live hacking circuit for, you know, a long time, because we get so much insight into each other's reports by just chatting while we're there live at the events. And I'll never forget this one like legendary event that we went to where Corbin Leo, CDL, figured out this way to leak essentially every ID that you would ever need, because all of the IDs were getting put in the URL, and he found this endpoint where it was just like a metrics endpoint. It was just dumping all of the URLs that anybody was
having,
right? And so like it turned all of the things, you know, all of the bugs into,
they were like a mediums. Know,
yeah, they were mediums, and then they got bumped to highs, man. And so everybody was like pointing to this report, like, this is the way. This is the way you get the IDs. And it was just like, it was just, the cache was just flowing. And the program accepted it. They said, okay, yeah, there's a valid way that's active at the same time as these reports where you can enumerate it. And so Corbin got added to like 20 reports. And
that's amazing.
This one little like way to leak just the URLs got him so much money from collab splits.
Yeah, and in that example, he definitely deserved it because of that.
Oh, for sure.
I think sometimes what's nice about this is like you don't want to give up a large portion of your bug. And so you can just do a report pointer to a report you know about. And this is near and dear to my heart, because I, like, for some reason, if you like go look at my blog analytics, by far the most popular blog and that continues to do well on Google search is the one where I talk about how I think unguessable like IDs should be considered valid IDORs, even if it downgrades the severity. And so this is just another way to increase the severity there and show that impact. So
yeah, dude, man, you know, so glad to have you on the pod, Rez, like repping stuff like, you know, unguessable IDs should be valid IDORs. That's amazing. That's great, dude. Yeah. I really dig this too. I think Douglas has been putting out some great stuff. And man, has he been rocking it as a full-time bug bounty hunter or what? Like,
you have no idea. I think this is his best solo performing month ever.
Oh my gosh, dude. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, he found like three more criticals yesterday on Amazon.
Oh my gosh, Douglas. Man, dude, he's crushing it.
Yep, he is.
Wow. And I was going to say, because remember at the beginning of this, you said Douglas has got a cool like domain with his last name being Day. Dude, our last names are pretty cool too, right? Yours is Thacker,
which and has mine is Gardner. It. Yeah.
Right. You know, we got the hacker, we got the guard, you know, like.
That's true, but I don't know if we'll ever get TLDs for those. We'll see.
No, not going to happen. All right, man. Let's see what else.
If we got a hacker TLD, which is possible, maybe it could be Joseph T. Hacker.
Oh, there you go. That's good. That's good. But then people are going to think your last name is actually Hacker and right. your T is your middle initial.
That's true. That's true.
Oh, well. All right. So jumping back into the technical stuff, we got a write-up from Flat Security, our boy Uriotak, who is a legendary hunter and often goes after really traditionally intimidating targets like GitHub and does a lot of very heavy source code review. And he released a blog post from under Flat Security's domain, flat.tech, on called Clone to Leak, Your Git Credentials Belong to Us. And so, dude, I love this. I will share my screen this time. So sorry, Christian. Yes, I'm sharing the screen. So I love this blog post, dude. Like, look at this. Like, he just gives a TLDR up at the top that's like three paragraphs, right? Like super short. Not even three paragraphs. It's like three sentences. Yeah. And then, you know, we get into the thing. He's like, so there's this thing, Git Credential Protocol. Here's what it is, and gives like three paragraphs on it. And then each one of these like pretty impactful CVEs is like majority code block and then like three sentences. You know, it's just like so simplified and technical and beautiful, but he condenses it down in such a masterful way that it's so easy to consume. Like I just reread this in like 4 minutes before this episode, and it's just so easily consumable. So that just really shows that somebody has true mastery over something when they can condense it down to something so simple and minimal.
That's right.
Yeah. So anyway, what I was going to say about this, sorry, I fanboyed about the style and I didn't even get to any of the content. The major takeaway from this for me was this section right here, where he's talking about, so let me just give the concept behind this whole thing. He's attacking Git, in so many ways. He's attacking the CLI, the Git desktop, Git itself. And what he's manipulating is primarily differences between the way that Git credential protocol perceives new line characters, which is just a slash n, you know, backslash n, and the way that JavaScript or any of these languages that he's working with, I think there's .NET in there as well, the way that they perceive new lines when parsing values. So he's talking about how regular expressions in ECMAScript, when you use the multi-line flag on the regular expression, have four different types of line terminators. There's there's the backslash N, the backslash R, and then there's two special ones that everybody who listens to this podcast must know from like off the top of their head, okay? Listen up, guys. It's backslash U2028, right? This is a Unicode code point, so it's not like actually that, but it represents a specific character. And that's a line separator, and then there's the paragraph separator, which is 2029. And dude, these two things cause so many bugs because protocols don't expect these to be line separators, and they are in JavaScript, which caused a mismatch that would leak your Git credentials when you cloned a repo. For this write up by Rotok. So
what's the hexadecimal representation of those two?
These are Unicode, so this is like you can't represent it in traditional hexadecimal format. Yeah. This is like the closest you can get with a Unicode code point.
Cool.
Yeah. And so anyway, I'm not going to go through all the details of this. He does the same thing with StreamReader in .NET. He does the same thing with some other code pieces here in C and Go. And he found like six CVEs on Git-related stuff. That's definitely worth checking out. But the main takeaway here, 2028, Unicode code point 2028, 2029.
Yep.
Those are separators. And know that when you're using regular expressions in like ECMAScript, in JavaScript, those are line separators on the multi-line. That's going to cause a lot of other bugs. And then most of the other stuff there is just like, you know, he did really in-depth code analysis and figured out these logic errors inside of various Git products and attacked also CodeSpaces, which is such an amazing product to go after. Have you played with CodeSpaces at all?
I haven't.
Dude, CodeSpaces is crazy because it's like they just spin up a environment for you to run your code in.
Is that like when you hit dot on a GitHub repo and it just opens? Is that Spaces?
Sort of like that. It's not Spaces. Okay. That's the IDE version. But then like it takes it a step further where it'll spin up like a little server where you can run the code and stuff like that. Is very cool attack surface.
Was that the target for that GitHub event that happened like a year or two ago?
It was, dude. And okay, we found so many bugs in there. And, you know, Uriotak is still finding bugs later. Yeah. So
it's hard to secure infrastructure when you're spinning it up like that.
It super is, man. Super is. So really, really ripe attack surface there.
Yeah, I love that because I feel like you would almost redefine hacking as just like playing with special characters.
Yeah.
Like it's so much. I mean, all of Orange's research, all of Realtek's research here. It's like, man, there's so many nuances that are really hard. Even that those like invisible prompt injection jailbreak stuff that we, you know, covered a long time ago. Like there's so much with special characters and Unicode characters. Any good hacker notes to use %OO, %OA, %OD. It's like all these things that we're throwing in reverse. Exactly. So sweet. Honestly, let's just skip this last one. We'll link to it, but I feel like we want to get to the meat of our content. The last thing we had, which we'll drop in the show notes, is a really cool way to de-anonymize location stuff for, it was Signal and what else?
Discord.
It's for Signal and Discord. Pretty neat. I mean, it's basically using like content delivery networks to the exact word for it is called cache geolocation attacks. But basically you can kind of de-anonymize things by looking at where specific traffic comes from on Cloudflare or other CDNs.
Yeah, really liked this write-up. And you know what's crazy to me, man? I know we're going to not spend too long on it, but like click on this like by this guy Hacker Mondev, who's 15 years old, by the way, which is crazy. And just look how many comments are on this thing. There's like hundreds of comments on this thing, and I'm like, what kind of engagement? Like, if you posted this on Twitter or like LinkedIn or anything, you're not going to get this much. Why is it just getting like insane amount of engagement?
It's a good question.
Maybe that's a new hack.
Use just I don't know if it's because it was linked somewhere else. Like, it'd be really interesting to know if this got high up on Hacker News or something, or Reddit or something. But I mean, he deserves all of this fanfare, that's for sure. Yeah, it has 600 stars.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why is there no count of comments? I'm curious how many comments there are.
I don't know, but like I was like one of the first people that commented on it. And
your email's blown up.
And my email just filled with like, great work. Nice job, dude. Well done. You know, and it could be because he's 15 too, and people are like wanting to be like, you rock, dude. But I don't know. I just didn't expect to see that much response on a gist, you know?
Yeah.
So
cool.
Okay.
So the meat of the episode is what? Tell us, Justin.
So meat of the episode is alternative recon techniques. And dude, I'm so questioning myself right now about, it's git, gist, and it's a GIF. GIF, yes, gist. Yeah, like I've never had a problem with this before, but for some reason this morning my brain is just not working. Okay.
I mean, that's how I say it. I'm sure people say it different ways, but.
Yeah. Okay. So the concept for this episode, and we got a little bit behind today, so this is probably going to have to be pretty tight, but we're just going to talk a little bit about alternative recon techniques. Mm-hmm. And like, what I mean by that is like, I feel like there's a lot of methodology out there that's core recon, like freaking subdomain enumeration via like subfinder, passive DNS sources. You know, then you brute force stuff, then you do permutations, then you do like freaking SSL certificate scanning, you know, all those sort of things. And this used to be like, some of those things used to be kind of alternative or like not mainstream, but now, you know, thanks to Jay Haddix and Nomsec and like, you know, all of those big recon guys out there that are sharing their techniques very willingly, it's become mainstream. And that sounded sarcastic. I actually mean, thank you. You know, I'm wearing a Nomsec shirt right now. I wouldn't be, you know, half the hacker I was without those two guys. But I just kind of wanted to take a second and go through some more alternative recon techniques that aren't as mainstream now. And just side of, you know, just in case anybody wants to go after some recon stuff. Now, you used to be / still are maybe a recon boy. You got anything to share here, Rezo?
So on what you just said, I mean, kudos to all of them. I think the Haddix recon methodology is how I got started. I literally walked through it step by step, set up my server, and then literally followed along with Nahomsek, you know, and his hackalongs and did the same stuff. So yeah, I mean, we're all building on the shoulders of giants here. I do think there's a lot of room for cool alternative recon techniques. You know, I posted in the Critical Thinkers chat last week, the, you know, AI kind of subdomain guessing. And I think there's a lot of other really cool.
Yeah, that was really cool. Yeah, you released what was it? Cool AI.
AI? CEWLAI. But I think there's going to be a lot more of those. And I think that one blocker to all the stuff we're about to mention is that it requires coding. A lot of it does. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the past that's been harder, but now with the help of Cursor, with the help of like literally, even if you don't use Cursor, you just use ChatGPT or Claude, just say, hey, write me a script that monitors this or that does this thing. A lot of the ideas we're about to mention that Justin has like kind of laid out here, I think are much more possible even for people who are not, you know, expert developers because of the fact that we have AI to help us write that code or test it.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Cursor, man, is just indispensable. Like
it is.
We talk about it a lot, but I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole again. It's just, I just love it every time I use it.
Well, yeah. We're going to have to reach out to them as a sponsor is what we'll need to do.
Dude. Yeah. I mean, like, I want to sponsor them. You know, I want to give them more money. Like this is like one of those products where it's like, I just want to give them more money.
Right.
You know, like it's that good. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So first one that I had on the list was actually a shout out from Nogli that he mentioned on the podcast before, but I just kind of wanted to double click into a little bit again, which is what pages, like trying to solve the question, what pages have references to like the given target in their JS files or in the like HTML response, right? And you're going to get a lot of false positives here where it's like, you know, especially if you're looking for like www.google.com or whatever, sure. Right? Everything is going to be linking back to that.
Right.
But if you're dealing with like some pretty fringe subdomains or whatever, if one of the tips that Nogli had that landed him that token, which is that got that crazy bug that we talked about back in December, was just finding out which pages reference your target in their JavaScript files or in the HTML. And he does that via URL scan. Mm. And I just think there's going to be a lot of stuff you got to filter through on there, but I'm sure that there are things that will, you know, not pop up besides in that specific scenario, especially in today's super cloud-based architecture where they definitely spun up some cloud resource. Mm-hmm. There's no other identifier on that resource besides just that, you know, mentioned in the JavaScript files. And then, you know, if you find that resource, you're in great shape, but otherwise, you know, you're never going to find it.
Yeah, I think this is especially true now that we're getting more and more programs that are like anything we own, or even better, some companies are anything that impacts us. T-Mobile is historically like this. It's like, if you can get this flag through any means necessary besides, you know, breaking into our building or whatever, then we'll pay you. And I think there are other companies that are at that level. I would say, I think Google can be that way with some of their core assets.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I
especially
think,
especially if user data is affected for Google.
Right. And so I think doing that's like huge. And the reason why I like the URL scan shout out is because it's something that's just so easy to work into your workflow. The same way I'm sure you also do this with GitHub. I do this. It's like anytime I'm working with like a random subdomain or a random cookie name or something, I always Google it in quotes. And then I always search it in GitHub with quotes. And now I hadn't thought about it before, start searching for that same thing in URL scan. It's like, those are three things I check really quickly to be like, is there anything out there about this obscure asset?
Yeah. Yeah. And I love it when I throw it into GitHub and like, I just see, cause you know, it does takes a little while to do the code search. Right.
Yeah.
And then, so like my eyes just sort of laser in on like the code search and it's going dot, 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 dot. And then when it comes up with something that's not a zero,
yes.
I'm like, yes. And then I go to it and it's like somebody putting their freaking
recon data online.
Recon data on GitHub. Oh my God. It's the worst, man. But yeah, no, but sometimes there is really cool, like, you know, some dev stuck a subdomain reference in there. And then I know like,
I saw that with dot files just recently, a Google engineer had threw something in a dot file
and put their dot files on GitHub.
Yes. Yeah. And I haven't reported it and it's like not that sensitive, but it's kind of interesting. It's like a, you know, it's like the name of a model of like a, you know, like a little coding model. And so it's kind of interesting. I'll share it with you afterwards.
But. Yeah. Show me that after. Okay. So then, guys, I'm getting a little bit off topic here, but we did do the first like critical research lab team meeting, right? Which was great. We had, you know, the whole team there and we were kind of talking about all these research areas that we were going to go after as a team. And one of the ones that popped up from Kevin Mizu was the fact that there is this protocol surrounding, I guess, chips, which is a new feature for cookies. That allows you to partition various cookies. And it is a part of the whole suite of protections that Google is releasing in Chrome related to third-party cookies and the effect that, you know, trying to limit those. And one of the solutions that they have is they have sort of like an HSTS-like list, which is just a JSON file on GitHub, of third parties that you authorize to have third-party relationship with your domain.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, this is kind of an interesting recon technique as well, is like, go to this JSON file and look for your target and see whether they've defined like relationships with third parties where those third party cookies could be defined. And then try to have an XSS or something like that on that third party, and then use that XSS to attack the main domain, sort of abusing that trust relationship.
Is there a specific name of that file?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll link it in the description, but it's under the Google Chrome GitHub repo, and it's called Related Website Sets, and it's just relatedwebsitesets.json.
Cool.
It's in the doc if you want to check it out right now.
Yeah. That's great.
So, you know, it's probably not going to be a massive win, but here's the thing, man, and I was going to elaborate on this a little bit as well, is like, when you're dealing with these really, really hardened targets, and these targets that are really value security, it really is the best route to attack the third parties that they are trusting their information with. Like, it's just, you know, like those third parties are just so much more vulnerable, and the impact is the same if they trust those third parties in a way that they give them code execution on their page or whatever. I think it can be a really big, I think the industry is moving in the direction, you know, for any program managers listening here, is like, you have to accept responsibility for what impacts your websites, not what code you wrote. Because at the end of the day, you made an active decision to trust this third party, to establish the third party trust relationship. And that active decision is the same as pushing code that is vulnerable, right? And you have to take responsibility for that. Attackers are going to manipulate it, and you're just exposing yourself to more risk if you are not taking responsibility.
Yeah, gimping your good guys, gimping your bug hunters who are helping you find these issues by not letting them look at it is just kind of silly when you think about that. The bad guys are still going to have the ability to use it and create the same impact. Maybe this means that downstream changes need to occur where when you sign a third-party agreement with some provider to use their service, they agree to cover some amount of the cost of any bug bounty reports that come in or something, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that could be integrated into the contracts. And I think there should be more thorough assessment of third parties before they are integrated, especially when you're dealing with high security websites like a bank or like, you know, a crypto exchange or something. Like, don't just be throwing some freaking support widget on there. Mm-hmm. Like, no. And I just want to say with that, like, I hope it was clear earlier when I was saying like threat models, you know, I have a Google Home sitting right in front of me, you know, listening to everything I say, you know, and I just don't care, right? Yep. So I like to think of myself as a pragmatist when it comes to security, and a realist. This is a problem. Like, this third party thing is actually a problem. And it's not a fake problem that we're trying to sort of inflate so because we want more bounties. It's like, this is the same thing as just having an XSS on www, right? And you can just steal people's credentials right out of the page or whatever, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's just that they don't see as much concern with dropping that widget on there when I think that they should. And so that's basically what we're raising here, so.
Yeah, 100%. All right, next one I had on the list here was Docker containers for source code leaks. Man, that one is nuts. And I've seen a couple players in the game, particularly Lupin and Ronnie Carta and that squad, really do a good job with this, where you know, just like people have built out full sort of recon infrastructures to scan GitHub for leaks, we need to be doing the same thing with Docker repos, you know, or Docker images. Clone them down, hop in there, scan for secrets, scan for references to your target company, bump back through all the version history for that repo, you know, or for that specific image. There have been tons of times where absolutely indispensable code to very high value exploits have been found inside these repos, and you just turn your engagement into a white box engagement.
Yeah, that's interesting. What do you think is the, like, do you think this could be turned into a tool where basically someone pulls down and indexes the data in there so someone can just search across it easily in some sort of front end app? Or do you think that
absolutely
a tool to do the actual downloading and grepping is more necessary?
I think there are some tools out there to do the downloading and grepping already, but man, it would be a cool service if you did like grep.app or whatever. I think they've got that for like GitHub.
Yeah.
It'd be cool if you did something like that for Docker containers, but dang, it'd be heavy, man, because those Docker containers are like, they are weighty. But I think you could probably do it in a really smart way, because a lot of the Docker containers do like a base image, and then they
you know, have a modification on top of that base image. So you might be able to graph it out, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a good way to know, like, are you just talking about the ones that are just out there on like the normal Docker hubs, or do you think?
Yeah, on Docker Hub. Okay. Yeah, thank you. I totally forgot to mention that. Yeah, I'm talking about Docker Hub. And I don't know, maybe there's other places where these are hosted. I've also sort of thought about maybe attacking the images that are on the cloud providers' websites. Like, I know mm-hmm. that if you go to EC2, you can go to like the EC2 store and like spin up Apache or WordPress or whatever. Those could also potentially have some valuable, you know, code inside them that they didn't realize they pushed.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking, because there's also like third-party Docker Hub stores basically for a lot of enterprise companies. Like, I'm sure Google has them, whatever, and it's like it just hosts a bunch of their own images. And so I'm sure that would be similarly, you know, beneficial to look through.
Yeah, that makes sense. The other one that I had on here, and before we go into diffing and like talking about API specs and stuff like that, is one of the ones from Jay Haddock. So, you know, I mentioned before he's been doing a great job disseminating high value recon techniques.
Yeah.
And this was one that he mentioned on the pod and also in his own framework. Like taking a domain, running a trace route on it, right, to see what name servers are associated with it, and then like querying those against those name servers in like a passive DNS sort of way, and saying like what other domains use those name servers.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of crazy to me that like he would do that, because like I was talking about before with Noggle's thing, there's just so many like false positives of sorts, right?
Right.
But I think the way that the industry is kind of going, a lot of the more specific recon techniques where you get like a well-defined hardcore hit,
yeah,
like just brute forcing subdomains or whatever, have kind of been enumerated, I feel like, in a big way. And then now what's going to happen, you know, where the game kind of goes is like, how do we weed out all of the fluff from these techniques that will just give us a ton of data back,
right,
and focus specifically only on the ones that are high value to our target. And mm-hmm. maybe there's some applications with AI there. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that you're just going to have to look for, like, it's not going to work for all companies. Like, if they're just using traditional name servers that everyone's using, then it might not be that fruitful. But if there's something custom in there where, like, there's a name server that only they use, and then you find some random asset that's also pointing at that, that's also using that same name server, you know they mm-hmm. own it, or that they're at least really closely related to it.
Yeah. So. It's helpful. It's a good technique. I was really surprised when I heard it, and I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. But yeah, lots of weeding through. But I mean, his testimonial from it was that they've gotten a lot of really good top level domain acquisition, you know, owned by an acquisition or something like that,
yeah,
sort of data out of that, which is super high value data, mm-hmm. right? Like if you get another top level domain, that can lead to like a mountain of bugs.
Yeah.
So really, really, really good stuff there.
Yeah. Do you mean to mention my operator thing?
Yeah. Yeah. That one was cool. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, I think in general, there's going to be a lot of cool ways to use AI. We're all about to have a bunch of our own little peons to go tell to do stuff. And so I was telling Justin before the call that a fun little alternative recon technique would be like having operator do recon for you. And so, and when I say operator, you know, any computer use system, and there's going to be a lot of them. Anthropic has an open source one that you can spin up in a VM right now if you need to. So, but what I had it do, which I thought was pretty neat, was Google dorking is always just a little bit manually intensive, and you copy, you paste, you look through, you copy, you paste, look through. And so I just took a list of all the popular Google dorks and then just gave it a company name or like a domain name. And I had operator start going through and doing that. And the issue was it ran to the CAPTCHA. So then I was able to use the CAPTCHA bypass we mentioned earlier. CAPTCHA enabled, and so then it kept going. I wonder if you could this is probably just a good tip for the listeners, but build basically, you know, maybe AI agents can't do it now, but we'll be able to do it in the future by like listing out your methodology of like, I do these Google dorks, I do these searches on GitHub, I do this search with URL scan, and then eventually you'll be able to hand that over to an AI agent, because none of that is like highly technically intensive work.
Yeah.
Just be like, hey, do all these things and just give me all the results. I'll go through them myself. Or, you know, don't mention stuff that's like clearly not benign. Like if there's a PDF to their, you know, terms and conditions, like ignore that. But if there's any interesting things in the Google Doc of the .pdf, right?
So real, like a PDF to their terms and conditions, definitely going to pop up, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God. Yeah, no, that's good, man. I think, you know, agentic structure and automation is huge, and will continue to be huge. And this is operator is going to be a part of that, I think. So very cool. Yeah. We got to bounce. But last thing that I just wanted to shout out there is, like, I think people sleep on like API spec or changelog diffing. I've mentioned it in the past. Mm-hmm. That is a really good recon technique, because not only does it give you, you know, draw your attention back to an asset that is changing, it's time bounded. It's, you know that they just pushed this, and it's very deterministic. Like we were talking about, a lot of the recon techniques are like very fluffy. You know, there's a lot of false positives. This one is like, nope, it's a new endpoint. You should go test that, you know, yes, sort of situation. So I think a lot of people sleep on that.
I'm good to stay on for a few if you want to stay on for just a few more, because I wanted to mention
these things. I got to bounce, unfortunately.
Okay, cool. So the one thing I was going to say real quick before we hop off is the fact that, one, Justin did release a really cool JavaScript monitoring thing in the Critical Thinkers chat for only Critical Thinkers exclusive content. So if you wanted access to that, you could always subscribe and get access to it. Two, there's a thing called BB scope where you can look for a new scope. Like, that's a kind of a way to diff and look for things. I think diffing for JavaScript, diffing for API endpoints to see what change is a really cool alternative recon technique that's custom and that's just going to pay you dividends. If you slowly set up one a week, man, in 2 years, how many are you going to have running? You're going to be just having like new stuff to look at every day. So
yeah,
no, get the ball rolling now.
Very good stuff there, man. And I think we probably could spend a little bit more time on alternative recon techniques. So we might do like part two of this one.
Yeah.
We had a big news day, but I think there's a lot of other ones out there that like are maybe not give you a hit all the time, but when they do give you a hit, it's going to be a hit that no one else has. And that's kind of the ones that I'm interested in for these.
Perfect.
Sweet. All right, man, is that a wrap on the pod?
Yes, sir. Thanks, y'all. See ya.
All right. Peace. And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.